Hello, and welcome to Friends for Life, a podcast of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's National Mission. We're here to come alongside you as we journey through life under the cross. What does it look like to care for our neighbors in body and soul? How do we tend to our own body and soul? How can we speak up for life? And finally, how do we share the faith with the next generation? Join us as we have these conversations and learn together. We hope you'll stick around and be our friends for life.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Steph Neugebauer, here with my guest, the Reverend Dr. Rick Serena. Rick, welcome. Would you please take some time to introduce yourself, what you do, maybe even tell us about your family?
Sure. Thanks, Steph. I appreciate you having me. I guess the best way I can describe it is I'm sort of a synod bureaucrat by day, and I'm a NASCAR dad by night or something along those lines. So I'm a Missouri Synod parish pastor. I've served parishes in rural West Texas, northern New Jersey. Currently, though, I'm called to serve the Synod's Commission on Theology and Church Relations. Not a lot of people know what that is, but it's a 20-member commission comprised of members from across the Synod, largely constituted by Synod and Convention, but also seminaries, universities, and so forth. And I'm one of the two staff theologians here who's charged with consulting with the commission, helping them prepare for their meetings, organize their materials, publish their materials, and so forth. Yeah, so we live here in St. Louis, my wife and I. We have six kids, 15, all the way down to one. I can't keep up with them now. I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to keep up with them in the future. My wife is a nurse, but currently she homeschools all six of our kids. So it's a pretty busy, pretty fun household, and we stay pretty active.
Yeah, I would imagine you do. Man, I can't think of a better combo to have in a mom than like a teacher and nurse at the same time.
Right. She wears so many different hats. It's extraordinary. My wife is one of seven. I'm an only child, so it's such a clash of cultures and backgrounds and contexts in our house, but it's fun. And it is a way for me to see how the kind of the theology that I study on a regular basis gets fleshed out in a very practical way at home.
Yeah. Well, that is family for you. All right. So you introduced a little bit about the CTCR, but you did mention that a lot of people don't really know that it exists or what it does. Specifically, can you tell us a little bit more about the papers that you produce and publish, what those actually mean for our church body and what you've been working on lately?
Yeah, sure. So the CTCR was formed in 1962. And it really kind of the goal was this. When contested theological matters come up, when new issues arise, we wanted to be able to speak with a single unified voice as Synod. So, you know, what we do as a commission is normally respond to if there is a controversial issue in the church, if there is maybe just a new challenge that we're facing, and nobody's really quite sure what a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod response to that should be, well, then the convention typically asks us to address that. And we do all sorts of other things. We conduct dialogues with other church bodies. We serve as sort of an internal theological consultant to the Synod and the International Center and so forth. So we do a lot of other things. But really, the thing that most people have come to know us by are these large reports that are often available online. There was a day when we would send them out to every church worker, every congregation. They would get a copy. Hopefully, we will be able to return to that at some point in time. But at any rate, the whole goal is not sort of to make a definitive statement about what the Synod must believe, right? Only Synod and Convention can kind of establish that sort of a position. What we do is we try and give advice, right? And that's how it should be.
My hope in the time that we have together is that we can talk just on an earthy level about a couple of angles of technology, one being social media, the technology in our hand on our smartphones. The other, as you kind of hit on, the generative AI, the ChatGPT, and how that affects us in our communal living, within our church family, within our own families, the four walls of our home. So I'm thankful to have you on. As we're working through this together, I'd love to hear some of your thoughts and your guidance, and of course your theological wisdom too. So first of all, since you are on the CTCR and your daily job literally involves engaging with issues of our day that intersect with the church's life, How has technology even become an issue, quote unquote? Because I don't know that really any time before maybe early 2000s when the rise of social media came that we even, maybe even as a church, needed to consider technology.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's moved fast, right, Steph? I mean, the last couple of decades have moved very rapidly on this score. I mean, the church has always had technology. You can go back throughout history, whether that's, you know, the development of certain forms of papyrus that you could print text on, right? Or you could write, rather, all the way to the printing press, right? Gutenberg in the 15th century that had such an influence upon the Reformation, the ability to spread ideas out of the Reformation. The Missouri Synod has not been averse to technology by any stretch of the imagination. Walter A. Meyer used the medium of radio to great effect. It was probably, without question, the most widely known Missouri Synod pastor, not of his day, but historically, right? We used to have a television program, and I even know that as a Lutheran television network of some sort, production company, right? That won an Emmy for religious programming. I'm saying 1974, they won an Emmy because for religious programming. They gave an Emmy for religious programming, and they won it, right? So we have a long history of using technology to great effect. But what's happening recently is really different. It's moved so fast. It's overtaken so much of our life. This is not about entertainment or education necessarily. This is about, you know, fundamentally how we communicate. Hmm. When I was in New Jersey, I taught a lot at Concordia Bronxville when it was still operational, and it was always sort of fun because in my classes I tended to have kind of really younger millennials, maybe the last couple of years going into Generation Z, and these were kids who did not consciously know a time without computer technologies, right? I mean, they just didn't. They were born in the 90s mostly, early 2000s. They knew a time maybe before smartphones. So I would always take them through this sort of exercise. It'd be like, all right, so do you remember a time before a smartphone? And they'd all raise their hands, right? And I'd say, all right, do you remember a time before cell phones or before the internet? And none of them would raise their hands. I'd say, okay, I remember, right? I was in college when I first got on the internet. I was in college when I first got, actually, no, I didn't get a cell phone until I was in seminary. So I remember that, but you know what I don't remember? I don't remember a time before cable TV, right? I don't remember a time before cable television, but my parents, you know, they didn't remember a time before, say, television. They certainly didn't remember a time before cars or radio. But my grandparents, they theoretically could remember a time before that. So you kind of trace this back far enough, and you realize that in the last 100 years, everything kind of necessary for our operation in life, how you get to church, how you make money, how you communicate, all of this is mediated through technologies that have arisen in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
Now compare that, right? Compare that with 2,000 years prior. The reality is that someone living in the 19th century probably has more in common on a day-to-day life with the disciples than they have with us in terms of the things that we do on a daily basis. This is futuristic science fiction, what you and I are doing right 50 years ago, right? Technology has progressed so rapidly, and we, to some degree, we don't understand how quickly that's happened or what the effects upon the way that we communicate and the way that we think, the way that we learn. We don't even quite grasp the impact of it. There was one of the articles I would have these students read was, it's called, Is Google Making Us Stupid? I think it was from The Atlantic, like 2012 or something. And the premise was this: well, you have access to immensely more information today because of the World Wide Web than any generation ever. But you also realize that. So what do you not do? You don't commit anything to memory. So when I was a kid in the sort of Paleolithic days of pre-internet, we had encyclopedias. So what do? I would if I wanted to learn something, I would have to look at the encyclopedia and I'd have to basically memorize it, right? I have to commit it to memory. Well, what do I do now? I just go to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
I have immediate access to it. And the premise of the article was, if you know that all you have to do is pull out your smartphone or go online to retrieve that information, you're not going to commit it to memory. Whereas if you knew that you did not have that option, then you would commit it to memory. So we have more information, but we're actually inherently less intelligent. We don't actually have it retrieved or retrievable, should I say. You know, my training, my background is actually as a church historian. I did my PhD in Reformation studies. So I'm always very interested, not so much in the kind of the nuts and bolts of technology. I don't understand that, but in the historical side, the historical progression of it, and how that development has impacted us and the way that we learn, the way we talk, the way we think, the way we interact with one another.
What are some dangers of technology evolving so rapidly that we haven't had a chance to even comprehend what's going on?
Well, they always say that ethics lags behind technology. One of the reasons for horns in cars is because all of a sudden all these dogs would run up to cars. They'd see this moving vehicle. They didn't know what it was, and people kept hitting dogs. So one of the reasons why they put horns in cars was to warn the dogs, keep them away, right? And I think that knowing what to do with it oftentimes follows only after mistakes that are, right? And you see the damage and the consequences of things. And I think one of the big things in our day and age, and this cuts across whether it's social media, any other form of information, communicating information, is we're just not really prepared for the deluge of information we get on a daily basis. Again, speaking historically, right? When I teach classes on the Reformation, I always point out the fact that when something happened internationally at the time of the Reformation, it could be weeks, months, potentially years before someone in a different part of Europe would find out about it. Something happens in Rome, it could be 6 months before Luther finds out about it in Wittenberg. There's a lag of time. Whereas for us, man, it is instantaneous. I mean, if something's happening right now that's of kind of universal significance, you and I are gonna have a notification that's gonna come up very shortly on our phones. We find out immediately, and that's a lot of times when it's not even confirmed, right? We get opinions or interpretations of contemporary events before we even really know what the event is or what happened. And I still remember when I was in St. Louis years ago, it was actually when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. And I distinctly remember this. I was working on a project at a coffee shop that day. And somehow I started following the pursuit of the perpetrators. And I don't know if you remember this, police authorities had to actually ask reporters to stop tweeting about it because the perpetrators knew that they knew where they were. And they were following online. And of course, all the media would descend to wherever they were hiding. And it basically prevented the police from catching them for a significant period of time. And that was kind of one of the first times it occurred to me that I'm not so sure this is healthy. I'm not so sure it's healthy for me to know in real time what's going on in a manhunt of some sort. And more broadly, Seth, I think that's a challenge for all of us. How do we process things? Do we have the time, the space, the distance to actually think well about things, or are we simply responding to information that's being thrown at us?
How does this all fundamentally change us? How does it change the way that we deal in our own vocations? How does this change the way that we communicate with each other? How does this change the way that the church sees the importance of embodiment and incarnational service and love and worship with one another too? How is this affecting us on a very human level?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, and I'm a theologian, so my initial response is always kind of to ask, how as a Christian am I potentially impacted negatively by some of this? And one of the ways, I think, is it's so easy for us to be taken in by new and different arguments that have some real implications for our Christian faith, for our understanding of morality, simply because those arguments are readily available to us. You don't need to spend too awful long on sort of the social media site formerly known as Twitter before you have all sorts of opinions that are rooted in very problematic ideas. One of the authors that I really like on this is Alan Jacobs. Jacobs is an Anglican literature professor at Baylor in Texas, and he's done a lot of stuff on teaching us how to think better, teaching us how to be more disciplined in our engagement with one another. But he has this really terrific book that came out, I don't even know how long ago now, called Breaking Bread with the Dead. His premise is that if you want to get a reprieve from this inundation of new and strange information and ideas that you're this kind of overwhelming us mentally today, you actually need to go read older authors. And he's got this quote that absolutely, he actually takes it from someone else. I can't recall whom, but he uses the basis of this book. And he says, your personal density is proportionate to your temporal bandwidth. Your personal density is proportionate to your temporal bandwidth. Really strange words, but all he's saying is this, right? Your personal density, how rooted you are, how fixed you are, how resistant you are to the tumult of all these new ideas and all these new arguments and all of these the strange information that's coming at you all the time, it's proportionate to your temporal bandwidth. That is, when you think, are you just thinking as sort of a 21st century American, or are you taking into account other perspectives? Do you understand that the tyranny of the immediate, as they always say, the pressing concern that's affecting you today is actually, in light of all history, is a much smaller. And so he urges the reading of old books that it stabilizes you. And again, I do get this kind of fascinating image of somebody being on social media or being on their smartphone with these push notifications that come through from all sorts of communication sources. And you're just constantly being battered. This is a very New Testament metaphor here. The wind and the waves of false doctrine adding you about. But one of the ways that you stay firm is realize this is not it, right?
Yeah.
This is not all there is. Christians have lived through much worse things. Christians have for centuries been thinking about far more profound things than what I'm thinking about in the moment or what issue is affecting me in the moment. And that provides comfort and solace and resistance to this sort of perpetual push and pull of new information, new idea, a new event, a new issue that you have to deal with.
That is probably part of the definition of wisdom, is beyond, you know, any kind of earthly Google knowledge, and really the perspective that is only from on high, that transcends human understanding but comes from God himself.
So another point I would always make in Reformation classes, I will tell students all the time, especially if I teach over here at the SEM, you actually know more than Martin Luther did. You do. You have far more, first of all, there's far more information available to you. There's far more things known about the natural world, about history, about there are more things written in literature. You know more than he did, far more information. But that doesn't mean you're smarter than him, right? Because you have not taken the time to reflect upon it in the way that he did. You have far more information, far more data at your disposal if we define intelligence by quantity, right? The amount that you have. But your ability to process that, to understand it rightly, and to be able to communicate it adequately and faithfully, we're not there. As you said, it's not to be sort of a anti-technology in any way, shape, or form. And the reality is that that's just where we are. And it's gonna continue like that. We're not gonna have less information in the future. We're gonna have more. We're not gonna have less conflicting information in the future. We're gonna have more. That's just the reality.
All right. So Rick Barna just came out with a report of their ongoing study that they're doing on technology. They said that parents have told Barna that as they're conducting this study, that parenting has never been harder than it is now, and the number one reason for that is technology. So you have 6 children. Your oldest is 15. So you've probably been dealing with this for a couple of years, especially now in a very real concentrated sense. Social media, technology, how do you see it affecting your own family? How do you see it affecting kids in general? And how do you see it affecting the church?
If I had to say as a parent, the thing that immediately strikes me is how different kids are, especially based upon gender. I mean, my boys and my girls use this sort of stuff very differently. When I mentioned we took the call here in summer of 2020, and my then 10-year-old daughter, maybe, she was our social butterfly. She had a ton of really close friends there. My oldest is just a very happy introvert. He's perfectly content to sit in his room and read all day. But my oldest daughter is very different. And so we kind of made a deal with her. We knew it was going to be heartbreaking to leave New Jersey and to leave friends. And I said, all right, we'll get you an iPod. This is for a 10-year-old. This was huge. So we got her the device so she could have access to her friends, right? She could communicate. Well, it was not even on our radar that there was something like TikTok that would all of a sudden be available. And so we just started noticing changes in attitude, changes in mood, changes in kind of just in her kind of communication patterns. And we very quickly realized it was because she had TikTok. And so then we had to kind of figure out some rules, some parameters around that, because we weren't going to just completely pull her off cold turkey. That's how she had all these connections with people back in New Jersey and some other friends. And especially during the pandemic, right? When you simply did not, for a year or so, regular communication and regular patterns of meeting people and greeting people and getting to know people, they just weren't happening. They were so disrupted.
Yeah.
So seeing her go through that, that was eye-opening to us, and realizing that we needed to monitor a little more closely what she was accessing. I think, again, for our girls, it's been a very different thing. It gives them immediately a mode of communication with other people that they crave. But it also comes with a host of other potential negative influences. And again, the research on this has been very prominent lately, that social media, especially for girls under 14, has drastic consequences for their self-image. Begin to view themselves in light of what other women look like, and that is that's causing sort of very deep depression and anxiety on their part. And so those things that, you know, for my wife and I, just would never occur to us that we would need to worry. Would always occur to us that on the internet you need to worry about what your kids are accessing, but the degree which that could affect somebody doesn't affect us like that, right? Because of where we are in life. And so that's something that we've had to pay a lot more attention to. We just got new phones this past week, and that was a big travail in the Serena household. Ours were dying, so we decided, you know, my daughter who's going to high school, we were gonna get a phone. And so we just kind of had to set some very clear boundaries for her, right? You know, we told her, listen, you no social media apps on your phone, and a phone is not to be in your room at night. And we had done that with my oldest, but it didn't matter to him, right? Because he didn't have any social media apps. He could sit there and watch old clips of Seinfeld on YouTube for hours on end, right? Well, we didn't have to worry about that with him, but we did it anyway. It's one thing to watch old Seinfeld clips on YouTube in the afternoon when you're supposed to be doing schoolwork. It's another thing to do it at midnight, right? When you should be sleeping. Mm-hmm. So we decided to move the phone out of his room as well. And I think, you know, they're very simple kind of practical steps, but simply having access to what you have access to online via smartphone is concerning as a parent, but B, also realizing that the access that you have to things like social media are so deleterious and harmful, especially for girls, and especially at that sort of very fragile time in their lives.
Well, you mentioned social media's impact on, especially with females, their self-image, looking at themselves over and against their peers or under and against their peers, the impulsivity of it, the fact that it's just always available, but anxiety and social media. What have the studies shown so far on the cause and effect of that?
Yeah, so and this is one of the things you and I have talked about before, Steph. The this recent book by Jonathan Haidt, The Anxious Generation. Not only has he studied a kind of the depression side of it, but yeah, this anxiety that's been created by your ability to mediate all your social interactions digitally. And you know, it's a very simple thing, right? So my wife and I, we go through this all the time, right? She'll text me something, and because she doesn't put like a smiling emoji, you know, I'm not sure, like, is she serious? Is she angry, right? And, you know, the way that we communicate in text without, you know, personal interaction, without a modulation in voice or a smile or a wink that lets you know everything's okay and that this is all in good fun. You read things all the time via text or email in a way that's never intended, right? And I think especially for kids who, generally speaking, my wife has to always tell my kids, don't believe anything your father says because 99% of the time he's joking. And it's true. My kids ask me a factual question and I always make something up. And that's not because I don't know it. Sometimes it is. But so kids kind of read things pretty straightforwardly, right? Yeah. And so they're not, they may not even ask the question, is this person joking, right? Is this person being serious? Mm-hmm. Is this person angry? And they all sort of just assume that the text as written is what the person means. There's no sarcasm or humor involved. And so I think that in and of itself, right, not having the personal relationship, personal interaction with somebody, being face-to-face with them, that in and of itself probably causes all sorts of personal tensions and anxiety. Does the person like me? Are they bothered by me writing them, texting them? It's very different when you're in person. Because the reality is, you know, kids are kids and kids are going to say mean things and kids are going to do mean things. I'm always very conscious of that when I get upset with my children, realizing that they are absolutely no worse than I was at that age. As a matter of fact, they are, by God's grace, much better human beings than I am. But that our communication is always going to be tinged with sinfulness. And it's hard to understand that and to read that and to respond appropriately when you're not actually face to face with somebody, right? It's actually much harder to sin when you look at somebody face to face than it is when you're not with them personally. Hmm.
Now, how have you seen the rise in social media, the expectation that relationships are kind of digitally based now? How have you seen that affect church life and people's desire to be in community in the flesh versus like maybe a tendency to stay at home, isolate, pick and choose involvement?
Well, I mean, it's very clear that we find greater fraternity amongst like-minded people online than we do amongst more diverse populations around us, right? The reality is you can, whether it's a subreddit or a Facebook group or a Twitter hashtag, you can find your group online that agrees with you. It's much harder to be in a community where you're not quite sure where somebody's coming from. Hmm. And I think that's, to some degree, one of the things I would say historically in the Missouri Synod is we've always been very like-minded. Historically, Missouri senators lived in similar kinds of communities, and many of them went to the same kinds of schools. And typically, I mean, not only had similar theological views, had similar social views, similar political views, and so forth. And of course, that's changed so massively in recent decades. And when you go into a Missouri Synod congregation, you're not always altogether sure where somebody's coming from socially or politically or culturally or any of these kinds of issues. It requires a degree of, I'd even say kind of sort of personal maturity to know how to interact with people who are different than you, or even the prospect that they may be different from you. The digital world offers a dangerous sort of safe haven for you. And all these studies we've seen recently, and this is no secret or anything, but the way in which information is communicated to us and shared with us is expressly designed to prevent you from changing your views. The Economist ran an issue not too long ago where they talked about the end of the social network. It's fascinating. They said sort of when things like Facebook started, the whole goal was to branch out. So you get connected with people. The argument of this Economist piece was that, well, it's actually completely inverted now. The algorithms, they don't expand your reach to connect you with people. They actually draw it back in so that the only things that you're getting via your feed are the things that you already like or the things that you already want to see. When that becomes, that echo chamber becomes our sole way of interacting with the world, you have different information than somebody else has. You have different circles than somebody else has. And while that's always part of human nature, I think, you are deceived into thinking that's what reality is. Hmm. And when it's a lot more complex, it's a lot more sticky, and it's a lot more diverse.
I could talk about this subject for a really long time still, but the point of this episode in particular is to really give us a starting point to consider some thoughts from a theologian to think about how we apply these concepts to our home, to our church life. The last thing I want to hit on real quick is AI. So in this Barna ongoing study that they have, they did a check-in with participants. And so far, they've said that nearly 3 in 4, about 72% of parents are concerned about AI's impact on children and teens. So AI, artificial intelligence, a specific sector, we could say, of technology. Specifically, generative AI, things like ChatGPT, how is it affecting our kids? And what kind of research or studies or reports are happening right now about how we incorporate this, if at all, in our church community life?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I will say this, at this stage, though AI has actually been going on, and it really started in the 1950s. There are a number of evolutions that have kind of brought it to the forefront in the last year and a half or so. But I think, in my opinion, it's really too early for us to even know how to respond theologically to AI. We've talked about the need for that, but at this stage, we need to know more about it, frankly. It's such sort of terra incognita for us in terms of influence upon Christians, influence upon the church. But it is, on a very practical level, right? This goes back to the way we learn and the way we're educated. My son will kill me for telling the story, so I'll just make sure he never listens. So he's a freshman. So we homeschool till high school, and in high school he goes to the Lutheran South here in St. Louis, and he got busted for using AI on an assignment. So what he had to do is for one class he didn't even know it existed. He didn't know ChatGPT existed. He was asked to download it for one assignment to test it out, and then he kind of cheated on another assignment, got busted, got in trouble, went through all this whole thing. And of course, at first I'm just the dramatic a father, like, I'm a pastor and my son is cheating on an assignment, and oh, I can't believe this, we raised you differently. And then it occurred to me, oh, so this is not his fault, right? It's actually my fault, because I hadn't prepared him. Right? So I mean, when I was a kid, if you cheated, you had to work, right? I mean, had to figure out, I mean, it wasn't as easy as just typing in a prompt in a program. Or you had to handwrite the entire essay from some copy from somebody else, and you would change a word here or there. Not that I did it, but I know people who did. Just hit me like a ton of bricks. Well, of course he's going to do that, because he hasn't been prepared for it yet. And a teacher saying don't use AI, he doesn't understand the implications of that necessarily. He needs to think through why you're doing your own work, right? And that the simply the fact that you can do something doesn't mean you should. So it was completely an error on my part. I hadn't prepared him for this. So, and it is interesting, this conversation has been going on at the seminaries, right? So I teach adjunct at the seminary here in St. Louis, and they actually came out with a policy for AI. And they essentially said this, and I hope I get this right. If not, they can yell at me. There's no rule prohibiting the use of AI, because the assumption is that you as a professor should never assign something that someone can use AI to answer. Because that's not what we're doing. We're not just trying to get people to provide very basic dat, right? Because that's what generative AI is, right? You're synthesizing and producing. We want critical evaluation. That's what a pastor needs. Yeah, you've got to have the nuts and bolts, but you have to figure out what to do with the nuts and bolts. That's what preaching is. That's what pastoral counseling is. That's what ministry is. Not simply spewing data. So I think that's a very kind of useful and helpful way to approach it. You're trying to cultivate people who think better theologically, not people who just have in their memory banks theological debt. We've started to have some preliminary conversations internally in the CTCR and really at seminaries and so forth about this. The image that we have these days of AI, it's sort of, you've probably never watched 2001 Space Odyssey. Right.
Do I look like I have watched?
Yeah, I don't know. Kinda.
I can guarantee my husband has. I will ask him.
Right. It's just this old Stanley Kubrick film from the late 60s, early 70s, and it's this computer that goes rogue, right? HAL 9000, I think it was his name. Computer that goes rogue, takes over in outer space and tries to kill the astronauts who are with him. And that's kind of the image we have. It's sort of this really dystopian future where the computers are running everything. And And that's where all the philosophical discourse is about that. I mean, I think for us, we haven't even kind of broached that yet. But if we do, I think it's really gonna force us to think a little more critically and analytically about the image of God, about what separates us from computers. Is it that a computer can communicate, process language, and communicate it at a better rate than us, right? With better accuracy than us? That does not mean there's something more to us than simply our rational souls, our ability to understand and articulate things, right? To get things right. So I think that's going to require a lot more examination in the future. But at this stage, frankly, the technology is still developing and our thinking about it is frankly way behind. Mm-hmm. We need to catch up.
What's your biggest advice, especially for parents, as they're helping their children navigate this ever-growing, ever-changing technological climate?
Don't freak out. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things. Because the moment you freak out, it's going to get a lot worse first. It's not going to get easier. I freaked out about my son. And in retrospect, there are some very basic conversations to be had that can improve the situation. And, you know, the other thing, too, my wife and I talk about this a lot, is, all the drama regarding smartphones and specifically this Jonathan Haidt book that essentially blames smartphones for all this depression and anxiety and children, because this what he calls the great rewiring of adolescence. You know, my wife and I look at each other and say, well, smartphones have done the same thing to us. We have all kinds of excuses for it, right? I've got how many email accounts on my phone, I've got work stuff and all banking, and we're on our phones constant. It's actually changed us. We're less engaged parents than I think we were a decade ago. I think we're less engaged spouses than we were a decade ago. We're far more easily influenced. I can talk about my daughter being influenced by something on TikTok or a text message, but we are too. So I think a lot of it is not just kids have a problem with social media or smartphones and we need to intervene. It's, you know, Rick and Christina have a problem with social media and smartphone text messages and emails, and we need to think long and hard about how we have been impacted by that and how it's affected our parenting, how it's affected us as spouses. So it's not, yeah. Don't freak out, A, and B, also take a good, long, hard look in the mirror and see how affected by it too. Measures you can take to change them. And that's not to say there are decisive measures you can take. This is the world we live in. But maybe there are safeguards we can put upon ourselves. Maybe just being aware of it is a significant part of it.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
If the next 15 years are the same as the last 15 years, I don't know where my one-year-old will be, right? In terms of what information she has access to, what technology she has access to, and the way in which she learns and comes to grow. So it's scary a little bit. I don't mean to be an alarmist by any stretch of the imagination, though. We have to take the good with the bad, and there's the bad with the good, and there's a lot of good that's come of technology, and a lot of bad, and I think we have to be mature and balanced, because we can't expect the kids to be, right? That's our responsibility, to be balanced for them.
Yeah, well, thank you, Rick, so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Anytime. I appreciate it.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review, and don't forget to click the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss out on upcoming episodes. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram as Friends for Life LCMS. And finally, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have an idea about a guest you'd like to hear from or a topic you want talked about? Email us at friendsforlife@lcms.org. We want to hear from you about what you want to hear about when it comes to issues of life.
Thanks for joining us. Friends for Life is a podcast that discusses the life God has given and the people He has called you to serve, right where you are, in God's mission.